Okay, so another episode of Just Me and Sim, and just why people are busy having real lives. So on Sunday, I was around Sim's house for an eagerly anticipated doubleheader of sports, which probably failed to deliver overall.
Yeah.
For the purpose of the vodcast, we'll stick to the Monaco GP section of that doubleheader.
Please.
We're not going to talk through the race kind of blow by blow because there wasn't a blow by blow of a race, really, but I think we've both kind of picked out a few points from the race just to have a discussion about and get our thoughts going. So obviously, going into the race, the most immediate anticipation was the forced two-stop strategy. It wasn't compound, was it? It was literal two sets they had to use.
Everyone was saying it was two-stop, but the actual wording of the rule was three sets of tyres during the race.
Yeah.
So, yeah, which... That's what Max Verstappen's strategy seemed to hinge on effectively near the end, that he could get a red flag to change his tyres and that would satisfy the rule. It wasn't that he had to pit again, he just had to change his tyres again, and obviously you can change your tyres under red flag with no penalty, so that's what he was doing by essentially staying out.
It's kind of brought up quite a few conversations. It would have been interesting if there was weather, because I believe whereas the two compound rule kind of gets voided if it's wet, the actual rule of the sets would have still been in place. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's exactly why they worded it like sets of tyres rather than compounds. So obviously you can still use three sets of inters in the race. It just forces you to change them twice. For once, I think F1 spotted the potential loophole in the wording of the rules and got ahead of it, even if it did, as always, create unintended consequences elsewhere, which I'm sure we'll touch on.
Yes, definitely. We kind of discussed, it's not just unique to us, but the prospect of maybe someone at the back pitting the first two laps and getting the stops done and then gambling on the risk of getting caught in the blue flag zone. We didn't see any of that. There was a couple of first lap pit stops. But overall, I don't think particularly stop-wise was anything that really stuck out that way. It was more the strategy of how the stops were completed that kind of blew the race apart. I was listening to the race's post-race discussion, and they were talking about how what was the word? They used a word, but basically it was a negative, how it didn't work. But I think, again, as we come on to more discussions about Monaco itself, it kind of did what really would have happened was when cars had a chance, they would use one car to drive 4 or 5 seconds a lap off the pace, build a gap for the car in front, let them get the free pit stop, swap places and do the same. Which really, when you think about it, I can't see how that would have been any different to what they expected. Like, it kind of just made sense to do that because I think we figured out it was, what, 4 laps of being off the pace just to build that gap. So it's not even like a long-term kind of effort. Racing Bulls kind of were the initial ones that really did that. McLaren did it as well, quite well. And then, Williams and Mercedes had their strange strategies later on. But overall, for me, the impact of the ruling, it wasn't a huge positive. It didn't transform the race or make anything like amazing happen. But at the same time, it wasn't a detriment. It didn't ruin anything or kind of change anything negatively for me. So I think if they were to keep it going, then I wouldn't have an issue with that.
Yeah. On the Racing Line app Discord, Dave actually said that he enjoyed the Monaco Grand Prix.
Hmm.
And while I wouldn't say I enjoyed it, I wouldn't say that I didn't enjoy it as well, if that makes sense. The two stops certainly threw up an element of interest on how it was going to run. Before every Grand Prix, Pirelli usually put out on social media a graphic of what they think will be the two most likely options. And usually it's like start on medium, switch to hards between laps 15 and 18, run for 30 laps, then switch back to mediums or something like that. And it's kind of interesting that for this one, they just put out a graphic that said, teams must use three sets of tyres during the race. They didn't even attempt to try and explain what the best strategy would be. In terms of the two stops, did it make any difference to the race? I'd say it added some intrigue, some interesting strategies, which thinking about it since the Grand Prix, there's nothing stopping the teams doing that in a one-stop race either.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing stopping you driving 4 or 5 seconds off the pace for 4 or 5 laps. To build a cushion for your teammates to take their one stop and then you switch them around and do them again. It's just because they have to do it twice that, you know, that's probably what's made people think about it more. Or I guess there's on a one-stop race, you can hold out hope for that safety car or red flag to get a cheap change. But if there's two stops, it's less likely you're going to get it twice to happen, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, I suddenly thought that this could be a strategy even in a one-stop race.
Yeah, that's good. Makes sense when you point that out.
Yeah. In terms of if they did it again next year, would have an issue with it. I mean, my thoughts on Monaco as a Grand Prix, as an F1 Grand Prix, are well known anyway, which I think, you know, we're well past Monaco. We don't need it anymore on the calendar. I'd happily transfer it elsewhere if we were to have the same next season. Yeah, I don't really see an issue with it. I know it's different rules for Monaco, but Monaco has different rules anyway. It doesn't run to the 300 kilometres that every other Grand Prix on the calendar does. So, yeah, it made it watchable. Would it be the same next year now we know how teams might approach it? Maybe not. Maybe it's just, you know, the novelty of it being the first time we've done it like this, not knowing what's going to happen. And as with all things in F1, the teams do it once and then work out the optimal strategy from there. And, you know, it's never as exciting.
I don't know if you can help clarify. I certainly felt some confusion with later on the race when you had the Mercedes that still hadn't stopped and then Max at the front kind of looking like it maybe wasn't stopping, like you say, I think holding out for a red flag. If they hadn't completed the two stops or used the three sets, would it have been a 30-second penalty per like non-pit stop, or would it have been a DQ? Because there seemed to be a bit of a mix-up between social media and what the commentary was saying.
Yeah, so usually, obviously, in a normal Grand Prix, you have to use two different compounds unless it's wet. And the penalty for not using two different compounds is 30 seconds. But that does seem to have been upgraded to a DQ for this. I'm the same as you. I've not been able to get or see a straight answer anywhere. ultimately, the pit delta was 20 seconds here. So even if the threat was 30 seconds, it makes no sense to take the 30-second penalty when you could pit for 20 seconds.
Yeah.
There's literally no benefit to doing it.
Yeah, it was a strange one. And like you say, unless you could somehow build that gap, but then you're still kind of risking the DQ.
Yeah, because if you could build a 30-second gap, then you just take the 20-second pit stop.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, on the other hand, Red Bull, they lost the Grand Prix in 2018 when Ricciardo pitted and they didn't have his tyres left. Valtteri Bottas had the world's longest pit stop at, what was it, 48 hours when they couldn't get a wheel off, is the argument. Yeah, you build your 30-second gap, your 40-second gap, and don't risk the pitting at all and just take the penalty and you still win by 10 seconds. So won't put it past Red Bull of all people to try that.
It was very funny. It was Red Bull that came the closest to trying that.
Yeah.
Testing the punishment anyway. We're talking of intentionally taking a penalty then. We'll move on to George Russell, probably the biggest shining light of the race, kind of entertainment-wise. What was your expectation then of when Russell kind of did the undertake and drove off? Were you expecting a more severe penalty? Were you expecting one that was in line with kind of previous penalties for the same incident?
So, yeah, normally it's a 10-second penalty. And when he did it and he said, oh, I'll take the penalty, I thought, that's actually pretty genius, you know. And then obviously they came through with he got a drive-through penalty for it, which he actually managed to make up for on track. So it was still beneficial for him to do what he did, which was, you know, he couldn't get past, I think it was Albon, wasn't it, he couldn't get past.
Yeah.
And he just, he skipped the chicane because Albon braked early, allegedly. Got past him, scarped off up the road. And yeah, I think he still benefited by a place over that. I mean, I think it was 12th instead of 13th he finished, or 11th instead of 12th. So yeah, then it turned out that actually the race directors had spotted that this might happen. And in the driver's briefing, we're very clear with the drivers that because of the nature of the Monaco circuit, if anybody skips the chicane, they were likely to not hand out the usual 10 seconds, but go for a drive-through penalty. So not only was he warned before the race that that might happen, he still chose to do it. But like I say, he benefited. He got up the road. So yeah, I don't like spending penalties, but you know, sometimes that's a smarter option.
Yeah, I was impressed by the brazenness of it. And the initial broadcast of his radio was, oh, we braked so early for the chicane. Yeah. He's like, yeah, plausible kind of explanation. And then he comes on the radio and says, I'll take the 10-second penalty. And you're kind of thinking, well, you're kind of goading the stewards at that point. And
yeah.
That's not really what you want to be doing. So I wasn't aware of the pre-race communication about the anticipation of that. So when the drive-through came, when it was given, yeah, I wasn't surprised by that or anything. Kind of, but it was quite, even in that specific moment, it was quite reasonable. But given the pre-race communication as well, then yeah. And fair, but still fair play for George to make it work and kind of still benefit from it even after a drive-through.
What did you think of the Antonelli one shortly after? Because on that one, I genuinely thought that Antonelli did get caught out by Albon's braking. From memory, he actually clipped the barrier on the right-hand side as well before going across the chicane. But then he slowed and let Albon back, and that was shortly after George had got the drive-through penalty. Personally, I think he probably should have took the chance there, because the fact that he clipped the barrier, or at least brushed the barrier, sort of says to me, you know what, this wasn't intentional. This was, he got caught out by Albon braking so early. Maybe I'd have taken my chances that I'd have only got a 10 seconds rather than a drive-through on that one.
Like, when you look at George's, it was a bit like he'd planned it. He knew that he was going to be breaking early into the chicane. So he's like, oh dear, he's broke early. I had to go round him.
Yeah.
Whereas kind of, yeah, there was nothing of that at Kimi's. It was like a oh shit moment.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're very contrasting in that sense. But I think Mercedes already seen that George, had he got the drive through by then? I can't remember
the time he had.
Yeah. So they kind of thought that's the worst case scenario. George made it work. He pulled the gap and kind of took the drive through. So, you know, could they have just done that with Kimi and said, well, crack on, lad.
Yeah.
Get your foot down, build the gap. Maybe it's kind of, they're a bit wary that George had, you know, like I said, goaded the stewards almost, kind of, so they kind of thought with Kimi, kind of just play it safe, play to the book, give the place back and try and send the good books.
Yeah.
So yeah, it would have been interesting to see them kind of push it with him as well, but fair play for kind of giving it back, even without being challenged about it. So yeah, I'd like to have seen a bit more of a brazen approach, kind of just the hell of it, but yeah, I think it worked out fair in the end. So talk about the chicane then. Are you aware of Alex Wirtz's suggestions for improving the circuit?
I am indeed, actually, yeah.
Yeah, because there was three, wasn't there? Moving the chicane further down.
Yes.
Moving the apex of Raskas and then opening up the hairpin, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The chicane one is the biggest one, isn't it? That's the kind of the one that everyone talks about first. Which is kind of a bold suggestion because it involves reprofiling the harbour, doesn't it?
Yeah, reclaiming land, which, I mean, they've just done that on the outside of whatever the corner is before the tunnel. Yeah. I don't know the name. We know I don't know the name. Let's not pretend that. You know, they've just reclaimed a load of land there. But yeah, I did quite like his suggestion. And I've got mixed feelings on that because his idea is you move it down towards Tabac, a corner I do know the name of. By about 50 metres, I think it was, which then straightens up the run out of the tunnel and gets you away from the bumps and the slot, that slight hump that's going into the braking zone into the chicane. And obviously his argument is that, you know, if it's a bit of an easier or a straighter braking zone, then drivers are more likely to have a go. But I like the fact the drivers have to brake sort of as they're hitting that bump. As we saw with Gasly at the start of the race, that can quite easily catch you out. He hit the brakes just as he was coming over that bump, which caused the rear to go light, and he lost it and smacked into the back of Tsunoda, I think it was, maybe. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a double-edged sword because I like the fact that the drivers have the potential to lose control of the cars coming over that bump, which creates a bit of a spectacle. But I'd also like to see more overtaken at Monaco. And, you know, the fact that it was only really Gasly who paid for that in the race, maybe if you trade that for two more overtakes, yeah, might be a good trade-off.
The impact as well is moving the chicane closer to Tabac. It's they're entering Tabac at a lower speed, which then removes the challenge off Tabac.
Yeah.
Obviously, you've got kind of Ralf Schumacher is the famous example of pushing it hard and hitting the barrier on the inside. But when they're approaching that at fourth or fifth gear, I think, then it's a lot more like kind of threading the needle rather than approaching it at third gear. Yeah, so I think that one particularly, Raskas, I was a bit like kind of, didn't see how much of a difference that would make. I think he was trying to encourage dive bombs, seemed to be the word he used a lot. Which I'm not quite sure on the encouragement of that from a man of his position.
I do kind of get it because I think it was straightening up the approach to the turn. I know a lot of people, you can't make changes to Monaco, it's a historic circuit. That entire section is new anyway.
Yeah.
So
it's really not as the same as you'd think it is.
Yeah, and while I'm all for encouraging, you know, having a go or a dive bomb at that corner, we've seen what happens there when two cars clash at that corner. It just blocks the track completely. So, that I didn't quite understand that one as well. I think that corner does suck people in as it is to having a go. I'd probably leave that one alone.
And then, the hairpin, which, again, a lot of people probably be like, oh, sacred hairpin, but...
Yeah,
I don't mind widening it, to be honest. I think the challenges there is literally Monaco itself. But
it wasn't so much widening it, was it? It was because at the minute it's sort of a, if you look at it, it's sort of a bulb, whereas you sort of have to go right to go left around it.
Yeah.
And his argument was you straighten the entrance up to it and then bring the exit back on itself a little bit more. And again, because you're braking in a straighter line, it should, in theory, encourage the drivers to have a go. And then by widening at the exit, obviously a little bit more room for drivers to run out side by side. But I think fundamentally the cars are just too big to do that at this track. Because there's only so much room you can widen it by. The cars are too long. They're too wide for this track. That's the crux of it. You can make the changes to the track you want. For all its sins, Formula E does have pretty good races here, and it's because the cars are smaller and they can run side by side and overtake.
That's a point. We won't share some of the votes' thoughts on Formula E kind of explicitly as they have been said, but it's not like when you look back when F1 cars were smaller that Monaco was a constant thrill. You know, this is nothing new with Monaco. So, yes, the cars are too big fundamentally. I think it's a mixture of both, maybe some slight track modifications kind of even just encourage people to have a go, whether they make it easier or not, with more realistic sizing of the cars. I think it's a combination of both that kind of needs to happen, but it's not going to make it, you know, a constant overtake fest.
But I think fundamentally, the teams and the cars are, and the drivers are too competent these days. And that's what it is. These drivers are capable of doing 78 laps at Monaco without making a major mistake that causes them to retire. The cars are built to last, you know, 6, 7, 8 Grand Prix for the engines, the gearboxes, so they don't fail as often. Alonso might have other things to say about that. But yeah, you know, and that's what caused chaos. It was the breaking down. I was watching the 96 Grand Prix the other week.
Panis one.
Yeah, the Panis one. And okay, I know it's wet, which is another element in there, but you know, you had drivers spinning off, hitting the barrier. You had Damon Hill's engine failing. I was watching, was it 97, where Schumacher messed up on the first lap and hit the barrier. The year after, where Alex Wurz and Schumacher were battling, and then Wurz appeared out of the tunnel with no wheels on the front of his car.
Still turning the steering wheel.
Exactly. But it's something I thought about for a long time, not just Monaco, but a lot of tracks. The drivers are just too competent these days. We don't have the mistakes and that create chaos. We don't have the cars breaking down to create that chaos. So we qualify all the cars in the order of fastest to slowest, and then the drivers are all capable of driving the cars within a tenth of each other. The cars are able to do that as well, and then we're surprised that, they drive around in that order.
It's something I did think, actually, that I was going to ask, kind of lean on your engineering expertise, and maybe my misunderstanding slightly, as usual, but as far as I remember now, the cars have fixed gear ratios, is it?
Like, correct,
so they're not individual, whereas it used to be like kind of almost individual per track. You watch some old Monaco on boards, and it's like bam, 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 bam through the gears.
Yeah.
So now, I mean, it's not going to be like kind of pulling away second in my Peugeot, but the cars aren't going to be as rapid out the corners, maybe, as they would be with the more individual gear ratios. Is that an impact, maybe, of the racing that kind of, you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I know what you're trying to say. Potentially. I mean, in theory, yes, because, you know, they choose their gear ratios at the start of the season, and now I've got to do everything from Monaco to Monza.
Yeah.
But the realistic realistically, they're not using 8th gear at Monaco. They might not even be using 7th gear. They're definitely not using 8th gear. And then at Monza, 1st gear is essentially pulling out the pit lane. So yeah, there might be some compromise for that, but I think in the race we were doing 1 minute 14s, 1 minute 15s, whereas Lando's pole was the first ever lap under 70 seconds. Everybody else was on 70 seconds. So there's a 4 second difference between qualifying and the race pace. And yeah, I don't think the gear ratios are going to make that much difference on that.
Okay, yeah.
Especially when you've got the likes of hybrid power and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Just something I thought of, kind of that I thought I'd ask.
Yeah.
But so thoughts on Monaco then? I think you've kind of just expressed you'd happily see it leave.
Yeah, the change I'd make to the track is I'd move the start-finish line about 1,000 miles north to Germany and run the race at the Nürburgring or Hockenheim instead. I think there's plenty of more suitable tracks. That being said, the Saturday at Monaco is one of the best days of the season because the qualifying session was absolutely fantastic. I think I shouted at the telly 3 times in a row as people crossed the lines and went ever faster. And it was just absolutely brilliant watching them build up to that crescendo at the end of qualifying. Just a shame the race is always a bit of a come down after that.
But I didn't see qualifying, so I'm up on that. I thought about it and I thought, I actually want to give kind of a staunch defence of Monaco. And
the floor is yours.
I want to keep it on the calendar for as long as possible. And there's a couple of angles for me that I want to go on. And the first one is, for me, it's still unique. And it's still unmatched in what it is. And, you know, I'm not going to say it's a great racetrack. It's not. But it's a great spectacle. It's a great event to have. And other tracks have come in trying to be similar. And one thing each one has had that Monaco hasn't is a gimmick for me. So Singapore has to run at night. Azerbaijan has that funny castle section and then the stupid long straight. Las Vegas is just one big gimmick and it's got that globe and whatever else you want to throw at it. Whereas they still don't capture the magic of Monaco for me that Monaco has in itself. And it may be kind of, you know, the mid-30s-ness of... When I grew up, Monaco was the one street track on the calendar. And it was that,
yeah.
And it really was kind of that unique event. And that's why it sticks with me. And I think, as you mentioned about qualifying, like what just watching the cars go round is still a level above any of the other street tracks that we go to. They still look incredible, despite the size, but seeing a car drive at that speed, like you say, sub 70 second lap, is still something great to witness. And I think even just watching trains of cars, I just think it looks great around Monaco. And I think if we lost Monaco, it'd be kind of losing. And again, it's kind of older people talking about heritage and legacy and you know, core tracks and things like that. But I think it really is a big part of Formula One in itself. I think Formula One without Monaco would be a very strange calendar and a very strange kind of set of events. Again, the events themselves are being superseded, even by kind of Miami. Again, Singapore, kind of, you know, the big flashy ones like that. But Monaco is still there. It's that historic kind of legacy that sticks in. And it's still so unique in itself that I think that's why I always want to see it. And I don't go into Monaco expecting an overtaking classic. And, you know, there's no overpowered DRS zones. There's no kind of super special corners. That's not what I watch. I go into watching the race with the mindset of this is just going to look good. I'm not going to be thrilled by overtakes. I'm not going to be thrilled by kind of undercuts, overcuts from the pit stops. This year, there kind of was the added intrigue of the stipulations and that helped kind of in that aspect. But I just like watching it, just like literally just visually looking at it. And that's what I really like. It doesn't need to run at night. It doesn't need any kind of special lighting effects. It doesn't need kind of, I mean, we talk about narrowness. There's literally the part of Baku where it is one car's width. Nothing is going to happen there. You know, there isn't particularly artificially anything like that at Monaco. It kind of all flows naturally. And yeah, that I do just really like it as the event it is.
I mean, I will say since F1 took over the broadcast of Monaco, it's become more watchable, even if the racing hasn't been better, because the camera angles, they seem to have come up with new camera angles, which look fantastic. In particular, that drone shot above the hairpin and the run into the hairpin, which just bought, yeah, I think you said it as well, it's like Grand Prix Manager 2.
Yeah.
You know, it felt like you're watching the race on that, and all I could think was a Stirling Moss. You know, oh, here we are at the Monaco Grand Prix and all that sort of stuff. And that was absolutely brilliant. And, you know, the better replays and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, as a spectacle, it is brilliant. And I do bellyache about it. And I do half jokingly say if it disappeared from the calendar, I don't think I'd miss it. But the fact of the matter is, I still carved out 2 hours of my Sunday to sit down and watch it. And every year it's on the calendar, I would continue to do so. And I don't do that of every track. I saw one race at the Indian Grand Prix, the Buddha circuit. I think I watched one Korean Grand Prix, and it's just, yeah, track didn't interest me. Whereas Monaco, every year I still find the time to watch it. So, yeah, there must be something about it that keeps me coming back. I guess it's, you don't have to fret of overtaking, but there's always the threat of something chaotic happening at Monaco. It's quite interesting, actually. On Riverside, there's a script button at the bottom, and I hit that. You might not have it. I have it as the host. And it came up, episode 20, Monaco Grand Prix. I was like, what? Has Matt already put a script in for this? And I realized it's a script that we used last year's Grand Prix. And it reminded me that, okay, yeah, it was boring because of the first lap crash that let everybody change tyres, but it still had that first lap crash.
That was
what's going on there? What was Perez doing? What was Ocon doing trying to overtake Gasly into the tunnel? It still generated the talking points. So, yeah, it has its merits.
Actually, you just mentioned that, maybe I think something else as well. Like that crash particularly, it's not a track where there's runoff where they can kind of push a car too hard a car. There's cranes all around the track. I think Brundle spoke about it.
Yeah.
And that in itself is kind of brilliant, that like an accident happens, they just pick the car up and just move it away.
Yeah.
But what that does then generally is opens up the underneath of the car to the world.
Yeah.
And there's been so many years of, like, was it a Red Bull the other year that got picked up and pictures all over the place and Horner threw a wobbly? And any excuse. But yeah, it's just a funny, that's just a little quirk that's kind of fun as well.
Yeah.
Fun with it. And I think that's what it is, isn't it? It's lots of little kind of individualities that all come together that really kind of show it off. That's kind of all the big talking points from Monaco without.
I will just say, well done, Lando, winning the race, getting your championship charge back on track, I think, with that. He was impressive. He's had the reputation as a bottler, putting that lap in qualifying and then following it up with the race performance, despite almost throwing it away at the first corner with that lock-up. hopefully he's got his head back into the right space. On the other hand, Oscar, I think he was off it all weekend. He's not quite there, but if a bad weekend still yields him third place, that's pretty good going for him as well. I don't think he'll be too disappointed.
I'll come on to the championship status in a second, because I think the next topic kind of is part of it. But a good showing for Ferrari as well. I think Charles Leclerc was quite complimentary about the mechanical grip of the car and how it handles the bumps and things like that, which is actually kind of unusual to hear from a Ferrari. But yeah, really good showing from them. And also, I tell you, I actually felt a bit sorry for Lawson. He kind of did his job perfectly for once with this race. It kind of come together for him. I believe before the race, he was kind of talking about how it's coming to, he's feeling it click, he's feeling it come together. I think having to drive 4 seconds a lap off the pace to build the gap for his teammate doesn't really kind of enable him to show that. But for both racing balls to come in the top 10, I think is actually a really strong result for them.
Is that a slight attitude change from Lawson? Because I think he's, the perspective of him to me, from seeing him on Drive to Survive and hearing him speak in general, is that he's all about him.
Mm.
But he played the team game perfectly there, because what had Jai came sixth, I want to say, in the end?
Sixth, yeah.
Cracking job from him. And yeah, he wouldn't have done that without what Lawson did.
Yeah.
So yeah, fair play to Lawson on that one. I did find it hilarious as well. I think it was Hadjar saying that he found it so boring. He actually doing really slow laps just so he could do a really quick lap to keep his concentration up, to be struggling to drive around so far off the pace.
Yeah. Again, giving Lawson that shout out, Hadjar getting the sixth place is a really strong result. To be fair, it's actually really good from the Racing Bulls and Ocon and Haas to kind of take advantage of Williams and Mercedes both being so far off. It was really good of them to kind of take that advantage and get them points there, because that's huge for them.
Yeah, fair play to Ocon. Yeah, I'm a fan of his. So yeah, well done. But like you say, I think he definitely benefited from the Lawson Williams shenanigans in creating gaps. That he was just the, you know, the happy benefactor from all of that.
Yeah, I think that was the interesting part of. I think it was interesting again with Russell. He got past Albon, but then Albon couldn't challenge Russell back. So Russell benefited from Albon still building that gap. Just happened that Russell was in that gap now. So yeah, again, how the strategies played out and the impact of them kind of overall through the grid. But moving forwards, and so going into Barcelona, there's the technical directive coming in with the flexi wings, which I believe is now a 10mm flex instead of a 15mm flex.
Yeah, 30% less than it was. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, which to me, kind of 5mm, but I suppose in engineering terms, that's still pretty massive. So what's your anticipation of the impact in this change then? Do you think there's going to be a big shake-up, or it's going to be business
absolutely
as usual?
Absolutely nothing will change, is my is my guess. I do think some teams have got the flexi wings down and they are seeing the benefit of it. But I think the benefit of the flexi wings is also massively overblown. The teams have all had long enough to come up with workarounds for this as well. So I imagine, yeah, you might see half a tenth here or there change between the teams. But I think the pecking order overall is probably not going to be too much different to where we saw Monaco or Imola or anywhere before that, really.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. I believe Sauber initially said they won't need to make any changes because they're so far off. Correct. They don't even have flexi wings.
Yeah,
I know Haas have said they hadn't. They could have pushed flexi wings more, but they chose not to because of this change. So there's obviously been different tactics going on. I imagine the likes of McLaren and Red Bull have probably pushed the flexi wings pretty hard just to stay at the front. You know,
well, like I think it's McLaren that's probably caused the whole flexi wing directive to come in the first place. And it's been Red Bull that's pushed for that. Probably talks to the various capabilities of the two cars on that one. Apparently Mercedes were quite heavily reliant on it. The sudden jump in performance we saw at the end of the last season and into this season was around their front wing package and how they've got that working. And then the other thing I heard was that apparently Ferrari are not really exploiting the flexi wings. And that's actually one of the reasons that Charles Leclerc was so fast in China without his end plate. Because without his end plate, it was causing the wing to flex. And so he was seeing the benefit that the other teams have planned. So don't know how true that is. Like I say, that's just from coming from listening to another podcast. So, but yeah, I don't think it's going to change anything. It'll be, you know, there'll be a lot of talk about it pre-race and all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the race, I don't think, you know, anybody will be talking about that.
Yeah, I think we're anticipating Spain to be a Red Bull track, kind of soon, and similar to Imola, which is going to be frustrating then, because if it is, you know, similar to Imola, people are going to jump on the, oh, McLaren have been pulled back by the flexi wing kind of directive, when really it probably, like you say, hasn't had that much of an impact, and we'll see as the season goes on overall. But yeah, it will be interesting. I can see more of an impact in the midfield than at the front, because again, it seems to be different teams have been choosing different kind of directions to go. But I'd imagine, you know, this directive has been quite a while coming, really. So even any team that was focusing on flexi wings will have been kind of working on ones to fit in the directive packages. Yeah. So they should be pretty well developed already going into it. It's not kind of a sudden change that's going to throw the field up into the air.
I mean, the flip side of that, like you say, the directive is only that it can flex 30% less. That's still only at the specific loads that the FIA test at. So it's entirely possible that McLaren are benefiting from flexi wings, and they've just spent the last 6 months working out how to make sure the wing passes the test, but then still flexes the same amount it does once it gets over that load. So, you know, such is the way is F1 of F1.
Yeah, as I said, you call it the VW method. Just pass the test. And yeah, so I think the impact on the championship, just to round off from Monaco and probably going forward from Spain, I think overall McLaren are probably still the strongest and probably the favourites. But we're seeing now more and more, and again, whether it's, you say, Red Bull or Max in particular, will be there when McLaren aren't kind of fully on it. That Max can be there to kind of close that gap and take advantage when he can. Ferrari, still so frustrating. They were right there in Monaco. I think for parts of it, Imola, they actually kind of showed some pace, but then other races, they will disappear. And then Mercedes and George Russell, he's had a couple of rough races now. He's had a great start to the season and the top five in every race, every official session. That's obviously been broken twice in a row. So whether they're kind of, they can get that back and kind of get back onto some form. Yeah, I still think you can't pick between Lando and Ocon currently who's going to be the driver's champion or even who's favourite for it. You can't write off Max. So yeah, I think it's still kind of quite similar overall in the title challenge kind of going forwards.
I don't know if you've seen the F1 social media, what they've been putting out this week. But one of the things I've seen all over the place is that we had the Spanish Grand Prix had 10 different winners in 10 years. With a graphic of 2006 to 2016, I think it was, or 07 to 16. 10 different winners in 10 years. Absolutely fantastic. But then if you look at every race from 2016 to 2024, there's only been two different winners. It's either been Lewis or Max. And then you talk about you can't overtake at Monaco, but 91% of the Grand Prix at Barcelona have been won from the front row. So I kind of think, I hate to say it, but I do think Max is probably most likely to come out of this one. But having said that, I think it was the last race he won last year, and he won here. Yeah. I think he then fluked a win in Canada due to safety car and then didn't win again until, when was it? America, Brazil, something like that. So
it was Brazil, because McLaren had an awful kind of weekend there.
They were strong last year with a car that wasn't performing. So maybe it'll be them this weekend again. Who knows? Does still feel like the title's wide open.
Yeah, which is kind of an excellent place to be, actually.
Yeah.
I've always kind of said over the past couple of years, it's not just because it's Max that it's not interesting. It could have been Lando dominating for 4 years in a row, and you kind of get a bit fed up with it. So, you know, Max being in the title battle is actually really good. And I think kind of Max fighting from the position he is, where he isn't kind of the number one driver in the championship. And he's kind of there through him, particularly. You know, we are going into races where we can maybe kind of pick a pattern on the type of track. So we can pick at Spain and say, well, kind of based on Imola, Red Bull are going to be strong. But we don't know that kind of particularly solidly. And, you know, Oscar could turn up and dominate by a lap, or Lando could turn up and win a scrap on the last lap. It literally could all happen. So it's a great place, actually. While there's all this kind of around F1, a lot of change, a lot of issues, actually at the core, we're having quite a decent title fight now.
Yeah, I mean, a discussion for another day about the merits of Lewis dominance versus Max dominance versus Schumacher dominance, I guess. But yeah, interesting. Like I say, I think it's probably the first title fight Max has been playing catch up in. Because even in 21, he was quite far ahead, wasn't he? So he was always leading. He always had the benefit of leading. Whereas now he's chasing. So maybe, that'll see a different Max, a different approach to racing. And yeah, it's going to be interesting, to say the least.
So that's the roundup of the Monaco talking points and a little bit of talk ahead of the Spanish Grand Prix. Obviously, if you listen to this after the Spanish Grand Prix, it's probably outdated pretty quickly, but hopefully most of it's been of some use of entertainment. And again, we will be back to more than two people on an episode very soon, I imagine. Like I say, it's just a lot of different things moving on in the background that need to get sorted. So hopefully kind of the double headers of me and Sim are kind of working for you and still keeping that entertainment up. Please remember to drop any reviews, 5-star reviews, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, any other podcast platform of your choice. Pocket Cast is a particular favourite of me and Sim as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But we do have the Racing Line Discord with a Vocast channel on it. We will pop a link to that in the show notes. Any opportunity for any chat you want to drop in there, or drop a comment on Spotify as well. So that's kind of a decent commenting platform now. So thanks for listening, and we'll have a follow-up following the Spanish Grand Prix and any other talking points next week.